This is the North Carolina Reading Service, and I'm John Federson. Welcome to Indie Week. This is a weekly publication. We read online from IndieWeek.com. It's June the 18th of 2026 is the dateline. You'll first hear it on the 19th, Friday. Then it will become a podcast, and it's all for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. And here we go. All right, well, much of the Indie Week issue is concerned with various budgets and city councils, and this is the time that these budgets are passed and some decisions are made, some hard ones, and so I'll read them as they show up on my list. First, Apex has passed a $262 million budget with a tax increase. Before their vote to adopt this $261 million budget for the upcoming fiscal year, Tuesday, Apex's five voting town council members all acknowledged it was a difficult decision for them to approve a 1.7 property tax increase for residents. Councilmember Ed Gray likened it to his 28-year-long marriage to his wife. "The smartest, most beautiful, most intelligent and caring person on this entire planet," he said. "Our secret is simple. No one's happy." I say that partially joking, but I also say that seriously. The budget that we are coming up with, no one is going to be happy with. I guarantee you that no one is going to be happy. Honestly, I don't know if anybody should be happy. The council had deliberated over three different budget proposals for several weeks leading up to Tuesday's vote, considering an original proposal from town staff that would have raised taxes by 3.5 cents, the revised and ultimately adopted 1.75-cent option and a 0-cent increase option pushed by Mayor Jacques Gilbert. At the last minute, Gilbert, who does not get to vote, presented another 0-cent increase proposal that would have deferred a number of planned town projects into the future, but preserved money for the town's public safety and infrastructure needs. Quote, "As mayor of this town, I'm looking for ways that we can be creative," and we've heard that from many members, like, "Hey, really dig deep and try to figure out, is there another way? I understand the needs of this community, but if we can get out of here tonight without a tax increase and still get many things accomplished, I would like my colleagues to strongly consider that and support it." His colleagues did not. The adopted budget for fiscal 26 and 7 is a 6.5 increase over the last fiscal year, according to Apex's budget and performance management director, Jessica Hoffman, and the new tax rate with the approved increase will be 37.35 cents. The budget increases the town's general fund to $122 million. General fund expenditures will cover a new fire administration building and renovations to a fire station, plus public safety radios, Go Apex transit improvements, and new bus stops. Capital equipment improvements and projects will total $14.6 million. The town will add 15.5 new positions, with 8 in public safety and the rest in parks and recreation, development, and internal services. Solid waste service fees will increase by $3 a month, while electric rates will go up 6.25%, or $10.25 per month increase for the average resident, said Hoffman. In total, residents will pay about $300 more annually for all services, including water and sewer. Mayor Pro Tem Terry Mahaffey said before the vote he doesn't take the decision to raise taxes lightly. He added Apex has, quote, "a really strong record of responsible budgeting in the past several years, with small or no tax increases, but the town is growing." Quote, "We can't ask residents to accept this and then fail to fund public basic safety standards that the growth requires. The budget does not fund every project as quickly as we might like, but it preserves the core responsibility of local government, keeping residents safe, maintaining essential services, and planning for infrastructure or growing community needs, parks, greenways, transportation connections, downtown infrastructure, playgrounds. These are not luxuries. These are what our residents expect of us, and it comes up time and time again in the service that we do. Ahead now, of course, over to Durham. We have several articles from Durham this week. Amid unprecedented property tax revenue shortfall, City of Durham passes budget after months of deliberation. The City Council unanimously passed its budget for upcoming 26-27 fiscal. That budget comes in at $767 million and holds the city's tax rate at 43.7 cents per $100 of assessed value. Numerous financial constraints, including uncertain state and federal support, an unstable national economy, and lower-than-expected property tax revenues, put the city manager and his staff in a bind when constructing this final proposal. But Mayor Leonardo Williams said the council was able to overcome disagreements about how to move forward with more limited resources. Quote, we were probably on seven different pages, and yet we somehow came to a consensus. This was Williams' fifth budget cycle and his third as mayor. Before that hearing could begin, a handful of demonstrators interrupted the meeting in protest of the treatment of incarcerated residents and the city's recent sweeps of homeless encampments, holding up signs and pacing around the dais before being removed by Durham police officers. One protester, who declined to speak to the press, was handcuffed in front of the dais before being escorted from the meeting along with three other protesters and released. That sidetracked that meeting for almost 10 minutes before discussion resumed. But throughout discussion of the budget, it was the revenue shortfall that took center stage. Both city and county budget were hampered by the unexpected and unprecedented budget shortfall due to large property tax reductions. Over 10,000 commercial and residential property tax appeals were submitted this cycle, significantly more than average, leading to a staggering $4.4 billion decline in assessed value, from which Durham governments, as well as most other local governments, generate a majority of revenue. That reduction translated to an unexpected $9 million loss in revenue for the city. Commercial properties in particular accounted for 93% of that reduction in assessed value countywide, despite making up just 12% of the appeals. That was revealed by an Indy investigation. Residents and members of the City Council honed in on that issue as a major point of concern for the city's financial outlook now and in the future. City Council Nate Baker said, this doesn't just affect the budget we're about to vote on this evening. It affects every budget until there is another revaluation. Council members and residents alike also noted wins in the budget, including raising the minimum livable wage for city employees to $25.09 per hour, and an additional 2% cost of living raise for all city staff. Go Durham buses also remain fare free for another year, supported by a one-time $8.2 million contribution from Go Triangle and Durham County. The budget also made investments in legal defense for people navigating eviction and immigration cases. Taylor Reynolds, senior staff attorney at Justice Matters, one of the organizations that administers legal aid for immigrants in Durham, had this to say. When we imagine what we want our community to look like in 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, this is an investment in workers, small businesses, and for our children and our schools. We're grateful this work that protects the lives of our immigrant neighbors will continue for the preservation of our beloved community and our beloved neighbors. Although the budget passed unanimously, City Council members spoke openly about how difficult the process was and how no one got everything they wanted. Freshman counselor Shanetta Burris said jokingly, "This is my first budget cycle, and I will say 0 out of 5 stars. The budget doesn't fund merit raises for city staff, and while it does keep buses fare free for a year, officials have warned that the long-term viability of fare-free buses will be revisited next cycle. To account for the shortfall, city budget staff had considered eliminating roughly $1 million in funds supporting local organizations and nonprofits like Durham Expunction and Restoration Program, DEAR, and the West End Community Foundation, WECF, in Lyon Park. Community members came out in droves to the June 1st budget public hearing expressing concerns over the impact cutting those supportive funds would have. Ferguson and city staff told the Indy they intend to dip into the fund balance, which is the city's savings account, to replenish the gap, but only as a one-time fix this budget cycle. Still, residents were effusive during that public hearing, expressing gratitude for restoring funding to important public initiatives like the DEAR program and WECF. The Durham District Attorney's Office was the only organization on the list that will have partial instead of full funding restored. The office stands to lose, therefore, some city grant-funded staff. Even though 80% of original funding was restored for those organizations, residents still pressed the city council on tackling the issue on everyone's mind this week, getting corporate landlords to pay up. Leslie Saint-Dre said to the council on Monday, "I hear you're mad about what happened, but it's your responsibility to use your leverage to get that money back." Mayor Williams said that measures would be taken to ensure equity in the tax revaluation process moving forward, while lamenting the city's limited control over taxing structures. No specifics were given. But Williams and Mayor Pro Tem Javier Caballero said the city would work closely with its county partners on the issue. And Williams said this regarding the corporate landlords who successfully appealed their property tax bill. "They followed the law. That doesn't mean the law works for our best interest. Those are just realities, and I'm not going to pit the community against one another. We're better off working as partners than enemies or adversaries. We need to get together, take our energies to Raleigh, and change the way the government works so we can actually have the power we need here at the local level." City staff have forecast that the funding challenges facing this year's budget are temporary. Durham expects to see growing sales tax revenue and more predictable modeling for property tax revenues moving forward. No matter how much money the city has to operate with, the city council staff and residents will need to bring a collaborative spirit to the table to ensure the most desirable outcomes for everyone involved. Burris said, "We're living in interesting times right now, but I do appreciate the fact this budget cycle was not contentious amongst me and my colleagues. We can get a lot further together if we have these hard conversations together, hear each other out, figure out a pathway forward, because we all have our different lived experiences that make us great, but we're not going to get anywhere far if we do not get together." Now, I would call this next article a follow-up, but it isn't really. This is somewhat of a precursor to the article about Durham taxes that I just told you. So I'm going to clip and edit some of this because it covers some of the same issues, specifically property taxes. They went up nearly universally last year in the wake of this countywide revaluation. So when city manager announced last month the city faces a $9 million budget deficit due to the low property tax revenue, council members were perplexed. All right. Tax Administrator K.R. Doyle presented a slide deck meant to explain the shortfall in May. Last year's revaluation, the first since 2019, produced the largest jump and assessed property values in county history, which in turn produced a record 10,500 appeals from property owners challenging them. Ultimately, a six-person board called Board of Equalization and Review, or BOER, granted enough of those appeals to result in a $4.5 billion reduction in the assessed value of property across the county. That drop translated to $9 million in lost revenue for the city as it collects property tax based on the value that Doyle's office calculates. While the tax office had expected to lose some assessed value to these appeals, Doyle told the council the reduction ran well past what his office had planned for. The budget shortfall stemmed from that gap. What was the revenue was expected and what actually materialized? No plan could have accounted for a value loss this size, Doyle added, because he said commercial properties filed more appeals and won larger sums than anyone could have expected. Council members were not hostile to that presentation, but they weren't satisfied either. Mayor Williams said he plans to request a deep dive to pinpoint the vulnerabilities in the systems that brought about the shortfall. Meanwhile, a six-week Indy investigation involving records of the 10,000-plus appeals, data from five public record sources, and hundreds of county, state, and corporate documents has produced answers to many of the questions the council raised. Among the Indy's biggest findings, relief flowed overwhelmingly to corporate landlords and to companies like Blackstone, Capital Broadcasting, IBM, Blue Cross, which just between the four of them had $500 million shaved off the assessed values of their properties. High-value property owners also didn't just secure the largest reductions, but faced better odds in the appeals process. So a low-income homeowner in Haiti was much less likely to get any reduction than, say, an Amazon warehouse. Also, big businesses saw their tax bills cut left and right, while the tax burden stayed on the shoulders of ordinary residents. There was also a meta-finding. Much of what Indy's analysis turned up does not align with the explanation Doyle and the tax office has given as to why the reduction ran so large and why they were not anticipated. $9 million is a small slice of the city's roughly $766 million budget, but most of that budget, which was approved by the City Council on June 15, is already spoken for by essential services, leaving a small pool of things for things like employee raises and park improvements. Both the size of the current shortfall and how late it came to light are unprecedented for the city of Durham, forcing even tougher budget trade-offs than usual, said a city spokesperson. The city was left in the dark about just how much property tax appeals would be cutting into its tax base until the 11th hour, so it wasn't able to take the steps it normally would when a revenue gap looms, like trimming spending. With options narrowed, the city has proposed freezing merit raises for city employees and eliminating nine staff positions in order to close the gap. So where the revenue went and why no alarm was raised sooner deserves a hard look. Sail a paper airplane off a downtown parking deck, it stands a good chance of drifting into a building whose owner just won a small fortune back from the county. Commercial properties accounted for 93% of the reduction in assessed value countywide, despite making up just 12% of appeals. The largest share of that $4.5 billion loss, over a third, came from commercial apartments. Successful appellants in this class range from brand-new luxury towers to decades-old complexes that cater to low-income tenants. Industrial properties made up the second largest chunk of the loss, among them an IBM-occupied data center campus that received a $330 million reduction in value. That was the greatest reduction of any single property, and the equivalent of $2.6 million off its property tax bill. Retail came next, with the owners of big box stores like Lowe's, Home Depot, Kohl's, and Sam's Club each winning value reductions north of $10 million, and Blue Heron, the firm behind the 9th Street Shopping Center, anchored by Harris Teeter, securing a $15 million reduction in value. Office buildings brought up the rear, as far as commercial property, make up 12% of the $4.5 billion reduction. The county has not published this sort of breakdown by property type, and when it does discuss which properties drove the value loss, its narrative only partially matches the numbers. Specifically, the county tends to name apartments and offices in the same breath, as though the two drove the loss in equal measure. During Doyle's May 27th presentation, for instance, Doyle named offices alongside apartments as a top driver of the reduction. And a county spokesperson stated the same in response to an Indy inquiry in April. The logic the county typically pairs with its emphasis on office reductions is easy to follow. That remote work has left office buildings vacant and eroded their value. But, of course, offices make up a small share of overall value loss, so it's curious that the tax office has invoked them so frequently. The county also traces apartment reductions, a genuine heavyweight, to vacancy issues. The tax office commercial supervisor, Jeremy Kahn, told the Indy last month the city's sweeping approval of new apartments in 22 and 23 led to more supply than demand, leaving apartments sitting vacant and pulling down their values. Pointing to apartments, though, comes with a complication that pointing to offices doesn't. Pin the loss on empty offices and the pandemic takes the blame. Pin it on empty apartments and you dredge up fraught debates about housing development. This precarity came through Doyle's presentation to council, where discussion of apartment vacancies went over awkwardly to a point that Doyle seemed to retreat to the depoliticized territory of offices. Quote, excuse me. Mayor Williams said, "I sense a road we may be going down for potential political argument." Williams routinely votes in favor of new housing development after Doyle linked apartment vacancies to major losses. Quote, "When you say there's a vacancy issue, I think we need to provide full context to that." Williams went on to caution against implying we don't need more housing, as that kind of rhetoric is going to hurt a lot of people. Doyle concurred and pivoted. "I agree. I think this is a bigger issue. It's not about Durham. There are multiple things impacting the office sector. I benefit. My office benefits from remote work. That's a real thing. It impacts the actual ability for these businesses to rent out space in the office buildings." Ahead of publishing this particular story, Indy put a series of written questions to the county. Asked about the weight it has placed on offices, the spokesperson said references to offices were meant to illustrate appraisal methodology in general terms, rather than to identify offices as a cause of the shortfall, and that its intention had been to convey that vacancy drove reductions in offices and apartments alike. Well, for homeowners, the deck was stacked. If you reached into a bag of all 10,500 appeals, chances are you'd pull out an ordinary homeowner's. Someone who, for example, opened their new tax bill last March, balked at a value that had risen twofold, and resolved to get it lowered. Residential owners filed many times more appeals than commercial owners, despite barely contributing to that $4.4 billion reduction. It might be tempting to write off this discrepancy, so many residential appeals, so little reduction, by reasoning that commercial property is worth more to begin with and would therefore account for more of the lost value. But that logic actually doesn't hold for a few reasons. Residential owners make up the bulk of the tax base. They paid 62% of the total property taxes billed countywide last year. So it would stand to reason the bulk of the reduction would be theirs too. Moreover, compared to commercial residential properties, are more likely to be overassessed and thus more likely to merit appeal in the first place, based on analyses by the University of North Carolina School of Government and DataWorks. In Durham, where sleek new builds often butt right up against aging homes, waves of construction or renovation routinely inflate the assessed values of humbler residences nearby. With that in mind, it's quite jarring that residential properties make up just 7% of the overall value loss. That figure stems in part for the fact that many homeowners don't know how to file appeals, but it also speaks to a gap in success rates between commercial and residential appeals following Durham's recent revaluation. The BOER granted reductions in 83% of commercial cases compared to 65% of residential ones. A Blackstone attorney and a family from Lakewood walked into their appeal hearings with very different odds of relief. For appeals that did not win a reduction, the outcome was typically no change. Increases were equally rare on both sides. Across the boards, more expensive properties won appeals more often. The spread is staggering. The lowest valued residential properties won a reduction 54% of the time, while the highest value commercials won 95% of the time. A modest bungalow contesting a few thousand dollars was far likelier to walk away empty-handed than a global corporation asking to shed millions. That imbalance, pricier property, better odds, is evident not just between residential and commercial appellants, but between appellants in the residential category itself. Of the $319 million in assessed value reduced during these appeals, $153 million went to landlords, investors, and developers whose property can be counted as residential when their holdings are small enough. In other words, homeowners received a share of the relief that fell well short of their share of the filings. Most of these findings went unaddressed during Doyle's presentation to council last month, though not for lack of council members asking. When member Carl Rist asked how much relief had gone to multifamily residential properties, Doyle didn't have the figures. When council member Chelsea Cook pressed Doyle on what share of commercial versus residential appeals were successful, he said it was a layered question and declined to give a number, saying he'd have to follow up. Doyle did hazard a guess when asked how much of the $4.4 billion reduction came from residential appeals, though he put the number in vaguely inflated terms, saying less than $1 billion, then closer to $500 million. Both descriptions technically hold true of the real figure, $319 million, though Doyle's phrasing tracks with an issue in the county's records. According to documents the Indy obtained, the tax office miscategorized a sizable chunk of commercial partials as residential, falsely bloating the residential total to close to $500 million. Parentheses, a county spokesperson said Doyle had spoken in approximations during his presentation because staff lacked exact figures at that meeting. Regarding the misclassified parcels, the spokesperson said property classifications sometimes need adjusting after the property use is confirmed. Residential appeals took on an outsized weight elsewhere in Doyle's presentation, too. At one point, he walked the council through a table of median property sale prices, connecting it to a cooling market he implied was part of the backdrop to the overall reduction. But the table, which reflected only residential sales, a fact that Doyle did not mention to the council, had little to do with the reduction, which, of course, residential appeals barely moved. Asked about the table, a county spokesperson said the table was included in the presentation only to give general market context. As revenue loss loomed, the city drafted a budget in the dark. Losing assessed property value to appeals doesn't on its own produce a shortfall in the budget. A shortfall happens when tax revenue lands below what was expected. So especially on the heels of a countywide revaluation, it's incumbent on a tax office to accurately project how much property value will survive the appeals process, because when the numbers are that large, a shoddy projection could blow a massive hole in a budget. Evidently, the projection the tax office made last year fell short, resulting in the deficit that weighed on the just-passed city budget. How that happened and how long it took the county to get its arms around the issue makes for another confusing aspect of this saga. There's a state formula for how many appeals a given revaluation will generate. Last year for Durham, that formula predicted 12,600 appeals. Doyle knew this number. He was quoted citing it in an Indy article last April, saying, "I would expect us to have a historic amount of appeals." But as of the June 16, 2025 deadline for property owners to file appeals, in the wake of the revaluation crept closer, not many had come in. Doyle took this as a sign the historic wave he anticipated might not arrive. He recounted in his recent presentation to the city council, so with 2 weeks left before the deadline, he revised his estimate from 12,600 down to 7,500, a number he reached by extrapolating from the rate at which appeals had been arriving. That revised figure almost immediately became the basis for the revenue the city and county each projected for the year ahead. It also quickly became outdated. In the final 2 weeks before the deadline, 5,000 more appeals came rushing in. After that point, there was every reason to revisit those projections. The tax office had the real number of appeals, and because every appellant names the reduction they're seeking, they had a clear line of sight into how much value was on the line. But there is no indication that the tax office revised its projected revenue figures then or in the months that followed. Even 7 months on in late February, the county was still seemingly using the projection built on that estimate of 7,500. Citing it in a slide deck it presented at a county budget retreat, and by then, reductions had climbed to $2.1 billion, well past the $1.3 billion the tax office had projected for the entire cycle. And there were hundreds of appeals yet to be heard, most of them large commercial cases where owners had requested hefty reduction. And as a parenthesis, state law directs most appeal hearings to be held by December 1st, though continuances are allowed. Based on records released to Indy, Durham's BOER did not begin resolving commercial cases in earnest until mid-November. Meanwhile, also in February, the city was getting underway drafting its budget for the upcoming fiscal year. As departments laid out their needs, budget staff took stock of what the city could afford, referencing the revenue figures the tax office had prepared. It took 2 more months for the city to learn the full scope of the impact the reductions would have on its revenue. It wasn't notified by the county until April 13th, a city spokesperson confirmed to the Indy, much later in the budget process timeline than usual. And, of course, that made for a tight turnaround. An April 28th email to council members and staff that Indy obtained, Ferguson, city manager, wrote, "Despite just having finished drafting the upcoming fiscal year budget, an unexpected shortfall meant he and his staff would be going back to the drawing board less than a month before that budget was due to be unveiled." Ferguson also wrote that when staff had checked in with the county earlier in the year, quote, "our assessed values appeared on track and our tax collections were strong." So, how does the county explain the timing? Reached for comment, a county spokesperson said many of the largest reductions weren't decided until late into March and April, which in the spokesperson's telling kept the tax office from knowing how big the reductions would get. The spokesperson also told Indy that in September, in response to the crush of appeals, the tax office attempted to create a second BOER to move cases through faster, but a second board never materialized, quote, based on the applicant pool. And parentheses here, the board's members are appointed by county commissioners and are paid $35 an hour. The current board's six members are all current or former realtors, developers, and appraisers. The fact that many appeals were decided later than usual does not explain the county's apparent inaction in the face of this tsunami forming on the horizon. Asked why it didn't flag the problem sooner, the county spokesperson said the tax office did tell the city in February that reductions could, quote, materially affect anticipated revenue, with updated figures following in March. The city, asked by Indy what it knew in February, reiterated it didn't learn the scale of the reductions until April. While the number of appeals the county received last June was indeed historic, that tally only goes so far in explaining the magnitude of the reduction. Even if, Doyle had estimated, ahead of the appeals deadline, exactly how many appeals would be filed, the standard formula for projecting value loss still would have come in $2.5 billion short of what ultimately took place. An unresolved question. Why were the reductions so large that they blew past what even a correct appeal forecast would have predicted? The county has yet to offer a clear answer. But tidbits Doyle has dropped to the City Council and the Indy offer a hint. Doyle has said that the real estate market data the county used to aid its revaluation, data it bought from outside vendors to gauge market conditions as it set new property values, was, quote, bad data that didn't accurately reflect the market and caused appraisers to set values too high. Because of that, he said, the county and BOER had to swap the market data for self-reported data from property owners themselves when deciding to adjust value or whether. If the data pegged an apartment building's rental income higher than it actually was, for instance, the owner could appeal, submit their actual data, and win a lower valuation. But that's not how the process is supposed to work, according to decades of state property tax commission rulings. A property is meant to be valued on the income it could generate, what's typical for comparable properties on the market, not the actual income its owner reports. This keeps owners from winning tax breaks for vacancies they created or income lost to their own mismanagement. So while an owner's numbers might prompt a second look during an appeal, they're not supposed to override the county's market data. That's the reason the county buys the data in the first place. In his presentation to council, though, Doyle described his office's commercial appeal review process as closer to automatic deference. Quote, once you have shown us actuals, we have to replace the market data with self-reported, he said. Asked about the characterization of the appeals process, a county spokesperson said the county doesn't default to owners' figures, and the county weighs all evidence. That market data it buys, the data in its own system, and whatever an appellant submits, as state law requires. Of course, Doyle's office does not make final decisions. The board does. So the only way to know for sure what evidence the board weighed and how it justified decisions is to examine the hearing records. That's not possible currently, unfortunately, because the county does not publish the rationale for its appeal decisions, as many jurisdictions do. In response to a public records request, the tax office did share partial appeal records with Indy, but the comprehensive documentation Indy requested remains pending. It's unclear how much documentation of the process exists. Doyle and a subordinate tax division supervisor, Jack Streeter, both told Indy in May detailed minutes of last cycle's BOER hearings were not kept, despite a state statute requiring as much from such a quasi-judicial board, whose proceedings are meant to be documented in near verbatim detail. parentheses, a county spokesperson told Indy the tax office documentation practices for the board meant statutory requirements, but did not provide evidence that it did. The county hasn't posted any board minutes online in several years, and a records request the Indy filed weeks ago has gone unanswered. For now, the hard facts of why such big reductions were granted remain unknown to the Indy and seemingly to the tax office. In one conversation, Doyle with Indy cast the board's decision, not the tax office, as the thing that had gone awry, saying, had the board followed recommendations the county makes on each appeal, quote, we don't have those losses. Asked about the remark, a county spokesperson said the board acts independently by law, and its diversion from staff recommendations is to be expected. As far as what the public knows about all this, the basis of the situation have been telegraphed by Ferguson, who's been vocal in attributing the budget shortfall to appeals by commercial property owners. Even without the nitty-gritty, that information, plus the cuts now pinching city workers, have given residents plenty to be up in arms. Dozens packed the chambers to speak during a city budget hearing June 1st, among them Edgar Ivan, a volunteer at Nuestro Barrio Liberation Center, who lamented the fact, quote, before we look at our supporting our city workers, Durham is stuck answering for this tragedy by commercial giants. It's alarming, Ivan said, but it's not surprising. A complex but worthwhile argument based on the, article based on the really unprecedented, misguided information or whatever. Well, another one from Durham. New zoning for the Garland District in East Durham could transform that historic neighborhood. Old East Durham has a long history as an industrial hub, but some property owners in the area want to further transform the district into a residential and commercial destination. Currently, the district is sliced up by incongruent zoning types. A significant portion of that area is still zoned for industrial uses, even as the neighborhood has slowly reconstituted to include more houses and small business. A group of residential and commercial property owners want to turn two blocks around the Anger Driver Corridor into a downtown area, complete with retail, maker spaces, restaurants, and a variety of housing options. Now, no specific plans have been filed, and any changes are still likely years away as the city makes improvements to the area's sewer system, which is currently at capacity, putting additional growth there on hold. The proposal, though, took an initial step on June 15 when the City Council approved the necessary rezoning by a vote of 5-2. In Durham's earliest incarnation, the district played host to the Durham Cotton Manufacturing Company, whose headquarters at the end of Driver Street is now occupied by chemical distributor Brenntag. The neighborhood surrounding the mill rapidly expanded to include housing, banks, and churches like the former Anger Avenue Baptist Church that sprung up at that time. Now, this is my own parenthesis, ladies and gentlemen. Brenntag chemical distributor has been in the news from Durham all quite a while due to chemical spills and non-compliance with some chemical-related issues which stem back decades in Durham. All right, enough of that. Decades after the mill closed, the industrial zoning lent itself to automotive shops, scrapyards, and crematoriums. In the early 2000s, as Durham began its economic rebound and downtown became oversaturated, folks took chances on cheaper spaces on the periphery of Main Street. Black entrepreneurs in particular coalesced around the historic Old East Durham neighborhood as a spiritual successor to Durham's Black Wall Street. But the current hodgepodge of zoning types limits development permitted in the area through an ordinance feature called nonconformity. Any changes to properties that don't conform to the current zoning rules, in this case homes and businesses in the industrial area, are prohibited. The rezoning effort is led by Garland Ventures, a group of local developers with a history of rehabilitating former industrial sites in Durham. John Warasala, one of the partners in Garland Ventures, said the owners of all the properties that will be rezoned opted to be included. Properties whose owners did not want to participate aren't. About 24 residential and commercial properties are included in this re-envisioned district. Garland Ventures owns 6, with 2 more under Warasala's name. He said at a previous city council meeting, "We're not some big out-of-town developer who's coming to try and rebuild an entire part of the city. We're local people who are working from the ground up to revitalize neighborhoods that have seen no improvements for decades." Warasala moved to Durham in the 90s and lives downtown, and his firm, Alliance Architecture, is responsible for rehabbing other former industrial centers like Golden Belt and American Tobacco Campus. And he said, "When we looked at East Durham, we said, this is distinctly not downtown. It's a very different scale of development, 2- and 3-story buildings where the commercial is on the ground and floor and residential a floor or two above that, but not 5 stories. The trade-off is that scale versus building big parking decks. The goal is to bring more foot traffic to this commercial corridor, providing a stronger customer base for the businesses in the area." Dan Jewell, who has been working as a developer in Durham for nearly 40 years and is also involved in this rezoning, said at the meeting, quote, "In talking to these people, our tenants, the tenants, and other folks in the neighborhood, it's clear what is needed is a lot more local foot traffic than is in there today to support these businesses. We can't do that with the current light industrial zoning." The city began exploring for options for rezoning the district several years ago. Business owners like Joe Bushvin, who opened his restaurant-turned-commissary kitchen Joe's Diner in 2010, told the Indy in 2017 the city had long neglected the district. Durham made some investments in the neighborhood. In 2013, they spent $4.8 million on improvements to streets, sidewalks, and utilities in the corridor. Popular businesses like Proximity Brewing, Rofewa Book Cafe, Mike D's Barbecue, and Ideals Sandwich Shop filled the vacant mill houses and empty commercial spaces soon after. The district has been moderately successful, building momentum in fits and starts. Rofewa, Proximity Brewing, and Mike D's recently closed their storefronts for varying reasons, but Dame's Chicken and Waffles relocated to that corridor late last year, and Ideals keeps a line around the block most days. The neighborhood also includes a couple of bars, a home goods store, a small grocery, and other retail options. It's also poised for growth. Another project, Brickworks, will substantially increase the population of the area. Durham Technical Community College is building housing not far from the proposed Garland District, and the city is exploring options for a transit substation nearby in the Village Shopping Center. Jewell and Warasala worked to restore the old Garland Woodcraft building, where Dames is now, after a major fire caused structural collapse years ago. The building is part of the East Durham Historic District that the city created in 2004, and Jewell said it won't be demolished as part of future plans for the area. At the June 15 meeting, the City Council approved changing the Garland District's properties zoning from industrial light to commercial general and commercial infill. The Planning Department created a commercial infill zoning district in 2018 to accommodate and encourage smaller-scale development. The designation has been used sparingly. West Chapel Hill Street is the most prominent example, but the zoning does pave the way for future projects in areas like West Chapel Hill Street and potentially the Angier Driver Corridor. Council members Senator Burris and Nate Baker voiced concerns about the proposed rezoning, citing environmental concerns and the lack of specific plans for the area. Burris pressed the developers on their plans for some of the industrial sites that might have contaminants in the land, as well as any contingency plans for any accidents on the railroad tracks that might affect the new residents Garland District is expecting to host. Brentag, a biotech company whose facility is across the tracks on the other side of Peabody Street, is currently being sued for polluting a nearby creek. Jewell said Garland Ventures would work with Durham Fire Department to understand what contingency plans are already in place and take additional steps if needed. Baker, along with Councilmember Chelsea Cook, both voted against the rezoning, raised concerns about approving the zoning change without a specific plan for the area in hand. Baker questioned whether waiting for the city to adopt new land use rules would give City Council, the Planning Department, and the neighborhood time to think about the area, quote, more holistically, and possibly create a small area plan for Garland District. Because the case is for rezoning without a specific development plan, Baker said the city is missing out on the opportunity to receive additional proffers from the applicants. The new zoning could allow future development by right without the applicants having to come back to the council for further approval and precluding the city from negotiating proffers like affordable housing or donations to public schools based on the impact of the project. Baker said, could we work on commitments that involve community investment, public investment, and infrastructure so that both private investments and public investments are greater than the sum of their parts? Jewell said that with the uncertainty around Durham's future land use rules and the sewer capacity issues in East Durham, as well as the lengthy development process, the Garland team wants to get out in front of any potential plans for the district as soon as possible. Still, the group is optimistic about the potential of this neighborhood. Two neighborhood residents spoke in favor of the rezoning, and Mayor Pro Tem Javier Caballero said the lack of opponents in City Hall suggested the Garland team had gotten a buy-in from the neighborhood. Warasilla hopes that the mix of modest commercial spaces and residential units will offer folks affordable opportunities to live and work in the Garland District. And he said, that neighborhood, to me, strikes me as the neighborhood where people make stuff. You know, it's made in Durham. That's where they're doing it. And those people should be able to live in the neighborhood. That's going to require the construction and everything else be not gigantic buildings that have a high price tag to them. They need to be moderately scaled and moderately priced. That's the goal. I have no idea what it's going to look like in the end, but I do know until we get the zoning change, we kind of can't do anything. Now, again, following the Durham City Council's budget on the city budget and county budget, this is another article, parts of which can serve as a backup to stuff that I've already read. Facing a tight budget year and a $9 million shortfall due to these property tax appeals, the city of Durham came close to slashing nearly $1 million in funding for partner organizations to help make ends meet. After City Manager Bo Ferguson proposed the funding cuts to help offset a budget deficit, the community pushed back at City Hall. The city now plans to dip into its savings, as I reported earlier, to restore $770,000 in the budget, which the City Council just voted on. Ferguson released a proposed budget on May 18th that would have eliminated nearly $1 million in funding to 8 partner organizations, and those included West End Community Foundation at Lyon Park and the Durham Expunction and Restoration Program, WECF and DEAR. At the time, Ferguson pointed to a, quote, one-time surge in successful property tax appeals, as we've already indicated extensively. Nonprofit leaders and beneficiaries rallied around organizations facing cuts, packing the city council meeting at June 1st during the budget discussion. Councilmember Shanetta Burris told Indy, "We have all heard the outcry, particularly around Lyon Park and some of the community groups that we have proposed funding cuts to. Then we discussed in detail their value adds to the community. It just didn't seem like a good moment to cut that." Unquote. to find the funding, which ranges from $2,700 for Little League Baseball to $250,000 for legal assistance, the city is pulling from its fund balance. That is a pool of savings reserved for emergencies. A spokesperson for the city said taking from this balance is a one-time fix, and the city will have to reevaluate next year whether funding to those organizations can continue. The city plans to restore full funding to 7 of the organizations and will restore half of its funding to the Durham County District Attorney's Office, which had faced the largest cut initially proposed. The funding cuts released in the proposed budget just 6 weeks before the start of the fiscal year blindsided some of the organization's leaders. The city received notice of tax revenue projections, as we've read earlier, later than usual, requiring the city manager to adjust the budget quickly and without advance notice. And Leonardo Williams, the mayor, quote, "It was morally wrong for organizations who have been partnering with the city to get a notification that within a month's time they would have no more funding." Emily Mistra, a project director who works with the DEAR program, said she is relieved to hear the city will maintain its $250,000 in funding. This program helps Durhamites restore suspended driver's licenses, clear charges, and convictions from their criminal records. Mr. said, "If we are going to need to find extra funding or additional funding, at least we have a runway to do that now." DEAR is the Durham branch of the Second Chance Project at Legal Aid, which offers expunction assistance statewide. At the program's inception in 2019, the city funded a grant that paid for 3 attorneys and a paralegal, said Mr. Now, the city's grant funds 1 attorney and a paralegal, positions the initial proposed budget would have cut. Funding cuts to DEAR would have moved Durham's expunction efforts to the statewide program, cutting the number of charges attorneys would have been able to expunge in Durham by 90%. Funding cuts would have entirely eliminated the driver's license restoration component, which is one of the few in the state. Well, I have to stop there, and in fact, I have to leave the broadcast for a few weeks, and you will be hearing, hopefully, if everything goes well, from Chris Conangla, reading the Indie Week in future weeks, and that is the voice you will very much approve of hearing. Good reader and excellent coherence, maybe more than you're getting from me, John Fetterson. But at any rate, I'll be away, and look forward to being back when I can get in. So this program will be a podcast right after the Friday broadcast. So for Indie Week and the Independent and the North Carolina Reading Service, goodbye, folks, and have a good weekend.